This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Gordon Hempton has found the quietest place in the United States. The acoustic ecologist who records sounds of the world has spent some 30 years trying to find the area most unaffected by the noise of industrialized America. Earlier this month, he said he found the place in the rainforest in Olympic National Park in Washington State. Hempton, who calls himself the Sound Tracker, joined us 6 years ago while still on this quest for quiet when his book One Square Inch of Silence, One Man's Quest to Preserve Quiet, was published. We discussed the sounds that surround us and the merits of noiselessness. Be quiet and listen. You live in one of the quietest towns in Washington, is that true?
I do. Joyce, Washington, a population of 100. And it's really so quiet here that I can use my backyard as a recording studio. In fact, I have, and I know that later on in the show, we'll be able to hear a beautiful little portrait of coyotes that was recorded from outside my bedroom window, and it's unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. But we'll get to that later.
Yes, we will. Yes, we will. And here's and this is something that you have written about. And frankly, as I was reading your book and just thinking about the various ways that silence sounds, how do you define what silence is in our noisy world?
Sure, I get that question a lot, especially since silence and quiet are used interchangeably often. And what I mean by silence is really that the noise of human activity is completely absent. We are talking about these last remaining great quiet places that are pure at least for 15 minutes or longer. That's the noise-free interval. An amazing fact today is that there are no quiet places, there are no experiences of silence 24/7 even. At the North Pole, for example, I've flown over the North Pole when I grab a flight from Chicago to London, that the modern measure is the noise-free interval. Now, when we get east of the Mississippi River, so all your broadcast listeners, they're pretty out of luck unless they really search deeply or study the map carefully, because there is so much overhead air traffic. And I know some folks, because I've been all over this country, some folks are going to say, oh, well, that's funny. I had a quiet experience just last weekend, and I'm sure it was an hour or two, and I really enjoyed it. Well, the sad fact is that noise-induced hearing loss is epidemic in this country. It's the number one occupational illness. And hearing loss, even among our children, has doubled in the last 20 years. So the chances that your quiet experience was as the result of a hearing loss is much more likely than you were indeed in a quiet place.
Well, and I do want to get to some of the so-called natural sounds that you have recorded, but let me begin with something that you recorded at the Indianapolis Speedway, just to get us all started. And you did this.
Oh, yeah, let's start in the fast lane.
Let's start in the fast lane, and let's listen to a recording that our guest made at the Indianapolis Speedway.
Yep.
Now, Gordon, yep. I have to say, because I've got headphones on here, that was really loud.
Oh, it was. It was 126 dB, and that's enough to damage your hearing, by the way. And there were only 40% of the crowd, of the thousands of people that were watching these Formula One tryouts, were wearing hearing protection. So it's really unfortunate for them. If that wasn't their first race, then they probably didn't notice as much as myself. I was wearing hearing protection, and it was still way too loud. But I'll tell you, it was still an exhilarating sound.
Oh, it is. It is. I mean, it's beautiful in many ways, just to hear sort of from the distance, and then it passes so quickly by you.
Absolutely. It's, you know, from just that sound quality, what an achievement it is to produce a machine like that, and then to drive it. It's just a remarkable sport, a remarkable feat.
Well, you know what? Let me play another sound you sent us, and I'm not going to identify it because I'd be curious what our listeners hear. And let's listen to this. Gordon Hempton, tell our listeners what that was.
Oh, absolutely. Marty, you bring me back to the early days of my work. And, you know, my day job while I trained to become the sound tracker was as a bike messenger in downtown Seattle. So I became very familiar with all these different listening opportunities in Seattle. And this is in South Seattle, an industrial area. It's at the loading docks, and we're inside of one of these very large petroleum fuel tanks that's about to be shipped up to Alaska on a barge. And I thought to myself, I'm going to come back and listen inside of there, bring my recording equipment, and I wonder what the city sounds like from inside this empty fuel tank. So while I was in there, the security guard came around, and he was a nice guy, and we had this conversation of, what are you doing? And I said, I'm listening. And Eddie goes, to what? And I said, well, right now to us. And he was listening too. And of course, our voices were just bouncing all around, filling the space. And we have some sounds of the industrial area also intruding into there. It's a very, you know, curious and I think sonically kind of a interesting work. It's really informative about the space.
Well, you know, and I was thinking, again, in preparation for the show, that sometimes it's hard to listen, whether it's a conversation or even in nature, to really listen to what's going on around. But if you take the time to do that, the more you listen, the more you hear.
Absolutely. And if you listen truly, okay, because a lot of people have the idea that when you listen for something. Well, if you're listening for something, you're just staying inside of that narrow expectation, your previous experience. But true listening is where you just simply open up and let everything in. And, of course, if you're in an urban area, that can be kind of a dangerous thing to do because you'll quickly get stressed out with all the noise. But when you're in a quiet place in nature, the listener's horizon is miles and miles away. In a quiet place such as Olympic National Park right here, you can easily hear the distant call of the elk from 8 to 10 miles away. Well, you do the math, and that quickly becomes like 100 square miles and more that you're taking in all at once. And it's, well, for me, it's pure music.
But what your recordings also show, I mean, this is maybe the dumbest thing I've ever said on the radio, which is that nature's not quiet. I mean, we talk about the noise of human-made activity, but when you listen to your recordings or actually spend time listening to nature, it's not quiet.
Wildlife.
Silent.
Marty, wildlife are as busy communicating as we are. And for their lives, they have things that are just as important or more important to say because they're attracting mates, they're establishing territory, they're navigating, in the case of marine mammals, and a pure acoustic environment for them is essential for their survival.
Well, you know, I want to play one more sound. We've got a full bank of calls here, and this is something you recorded. Actually, you mentioned this earlier, that you recorded from your bedroom window. It's a coyote or coyotes in Olympic National Park in Washington. Let's listen. Well, you do live in a quiet part of the world. That echo is pretty extraordinary.
Oh, I'm glad that you heard that, Marty.
I did.
You know, some people, they just hear the coyotes, and some people also call that a recording of silence made audible by the coyotes because those echoes are just so ever-expanding.
I want to try an experiment since we are on the radio, and on the radio, silence is a scary thing. It's the thing that we do everything to avoid. But I want to just do about 5 seconds of silence on the radio, Gordon, and I want you to tell us what you hear, okay? Let's listen. So what did you hear, Gordon Hempton?
Well, I heard my home here. I also heard out of my left ear the silence of this phone system, which is not silent. There is a hum that goes on. It's a bit like wearing hearing protection. So my natural instinct is I want to take it out to be closer to where I am. But my right ear was listening to a distant winter wren here in Joyce that's joyfully singing. So I had kind of a split-brain personality at that moment that my left and the right ear were having a bit of an argument. I know what you say when silence can be scary,
yeah.
And especially on radio, it's the scariest thing of all, because if it goes silent, people might change the channel.
And I was also thinking about there's a certain kind of silence if you're swimming underwater or jump into a pool. I happen to think it's a beautiful sound, but just that sound of maybe it's a kind of implosion into the water, and then what it feels like underwater when you're listening to that sound.
Yes, underwater, listening to the sound. And, of course, if we do that in a pool, it is quiet down there and soothing and refreshing, and I become reacquainted with how, without even thinking about it at a conscious level, how I had been craving that experience. Just to get away from all the demands of the information. Because when you think of it, the ear does not have earlids. We don't have a choice. All that sound that's coming at us from every direction, 24/7, day and night, is still reaching the brain and decisions are being made. And stress does occur in our lives. In fact, people that are next to light rail and even heavy rail tracks, for example, that have habituated to the sounds, loud sounds of noise intrusion, so they do sleep through the night. Well, medical studies have shown that even though they sleep through the night, the body still listens and the stress hormones are still being produced.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
That was my 2010 interview with acoustic ecologist Gordon Hempton about his book, One Square Inch of Silence. After the break, we'll hear about Benjamin Franklin. The anniversary of his death is on Sunday. Stay with us.
And the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence.
Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. This Sunday marks the 226th anniversary of Benjamin Franklin's death. The founding father is considered one of the most influential figures in shaping our nation. But in reality, Franklin was originally loyal to the British, defending the monarchy against those who wanted American independence. We discuss Franklin's transformation from devotee of the crown to American rebel when historian Gordon Wood joined us to talk about his book, The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. Let's take a listen. You say, you know, that there are many volumes of Benjamin Franklin's letters. So certainly we have his autobiography. And yet you also say in this book that he's a hard person to get to know. And this is, I guess, as a historian writing about him. How
right,
so?
Because he has so many personas. You never know whether he's being ironic or whether he's being sincere. He's constantly changing his point of view. He wrote from so many different pseudonyms.
Yes.
And took different positions. He would write as a New Englander, he'd write as a Londoner, and he would try to explain to other sides what, in the case of the imperial crisis, what the British thought or what the Americans thought. So he has so many so many personas that it's very difficult to pin him down. What does he really believe? The same is true of the autobiography. He's got a created character there, Benjamin Franklin, the young boy. And it's this discrepancy between the adult who's writing the book and the young man who comes into Philadelphia with a loaf of bread under his arm, wandering around Market Street, that creates the, I think, the humor and the irony of the autobiography.
What do you think then the public view of Benjamin Franklin is today?
Well, it's hard to know. I think that most people think of him as the representative or the symbol of the American dream, the young man who came from the most humble origins to become the most celebrated American in the world. I think he stands for social mobility. The autobiography, I think, still has meaning, that kind of meaning. Whether he still stands for capitalism the way he did in the first half of the 20th century, I think is less clear, largely because I think capitalism has lost with the fall of the Soviet Union, the end of Marxism, capitalism seems to be all we have, and therefore Franklin is not quite as much of an enemy as he had been in the 19th and early 20th century to imaginative writers and intellectuals. They saw Franklin as Babbitt and Main Street rolled into one, and obviously most imaginative writers and intellectuals don't like capitalism, so and money-making, and so in that sense, Franklin, the image of Franklin has softened, I think, a bit in the 21st century from what it was in the 19th century.
Well, and there was Mark Twain, Melville, Poe, D.H. Lawrence, all of them.
They all disliked him. They all thought of him as this money-grubbing Babbitt who bourgeois middle-class values. Of course, that's the other side of that is that this is what the middle class likes. So they want they like the man who comes up, pulls himself up by his own bootstraps, mm-hmm. and makes it.
You have a chapter here on becoming a gentleman, and this was something he was aspiring to. But you also say many young men at that time were aspiring to this higher status.
That's right. The distinction between gentlemen and ordinary people in the 18th century was very meaningful, not unlike today where gentleman is everybody's a gentleman. We put it on our restroom mm-hmm. doors. So the status had a distinctiveness that it's lost. A gentleman was a man of leisure. He didn't work for a living. His income had to come, or at least seemed to come, without exertion. And Franklin became very wealthy. Mm-hmm. And at the age of 42, in 1748, he retires from his business to become a gentleman. It's a very he has a coming out portrait painted. He moves from his shop where he lived above the shop, as most artisans did, to separate quarters. Buys two slaves and settles mm-hmm. down to a life of science, philosophical amusement, as he says, and more important, public service.
Well, and you also say that the patronage, as it was, I guess, done back then, was a way to this higher
status. That's right.
Status.
Well, he's not quite as self-made as the 19th century made him out to be. You couldn't have been in the 18th century. You needed patrons to sponsor you. And, of course, there were lots of patrons. They look around for bright lads and bring them along. Alexander Hamilton was rescued from his groveling obscurity, as he mm-hmm. called it, in Nevis in the Caribbean. And sent off to New York to college, you had to have somebody look after you. There's no way you could make it just on your own. And I think that the 19th mm-hmm. century created the myth of the self-made man. That there's no way. But of course, Franklin was a genius. He was very bright, and everybody recognized that.
What's so interesting in reading this book and reading your Benjamin Franklin is his deep ambivalence, I would say, about where he belonged, where his loyalties were. You write, far from being a natural and thoroughgoing American, Franklin at several points in his life experienced what we would call today the anxiety of national identity. How so?
Obviously, he was mixed up during the imperial crisis. That is the 1760s when the British Empire began coming apart and the North American colonies began to feel their own sense of identity, that Franklin was unclear on which side he belonged. He was loyal to the crown. He thought the British Empire was the greatest phenomenon of the 18th century. He wanted to be part of it. And he always valued America as well. He thought America would become, at some point, demographically, it would become the center of the empire. But it would always be the British Empire. Hmm. He did not want a separation. So he, when the two parts begin splitting, he's very much torn. He's trying to hold them together right through to almost to the very moment of the collapse of the empire.
Well, you say that he's one of the oldest of these founding fathers, and I wonder whether that in any way explains his loyalty to the crown.
That's a good point. He is by far older than the others. He's 70 years of age in 1770, and he's born in 1706. The next founder is George Washington, 1732. So you're talking about a whole generation older than the most of the founders. Madison and Hamilton, he's 50 years older than they are. So that may account for part of it, but I think it's because he spent so much time abroad. He really went abroad to turn Pennsylvania from a proprietary colony that is owned by the Penn family, essentially, in a feudal relationship, into a royal colony. Hmm. He wanted the crown to appoint the governor, the crown to directly control the government of Pennsylvania. And that effort, which seemed to many people, even back in Pennsylvania, they're not quite clear that they want the crown to be taking over. And particularly as the crisis breaks in the 1760s, more and more Pennsylvanians said, are we doing the right thing by royalizing this colony? Franklin has no doubts whatsoever that this is the best thing for Pennsylvania. His loyalty to the crown was as great as anyone's. And I think if you read his papers in the 1750s and early 60s, he's indistinguishable from Thomas Hutchinson, who becomes the arch Tory, the arch loyalist. He sounds like a loyalist or incipient loyalist. And in fact, I think if things had gone differently, he might very well have been a loyalist, as his son was.
Well,
son became royal governor.
Further complicated his life as well.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
What was his relationship with William Penn?
William Penn, he never knew William Penn. He knew the Penn family. Yeah, he hated Thomas Penn, who was the eldest of the Penns, and they had a terrible relationship. Penns, of course, were very suspicious of this man who was organizing armies, a private army, in a government that was presumably controlled by the Penn family, and here's this demagogue, as they saw it, Franklin, organizing an army right under their nose.
I'm still stuck on his, and this is maybe using 21st century thinking to understand someone who was born in 1706, but to understand his loyalty to the crown. And do you think it was there something about the pomp and circumstance of loyalty that he found attractive,
or the fact that
they liked him so much? As you said, he spent a fair amount of time.
Right. Of course, he is a world celebrity before he goes because of his scientific achievements, which are truly monumental. Right. I mean, he's not just an inventor. He's not an early version of Thomas Edison. He does invent things, and that's how we think of him. Right. But I think wrongly, because he does make fundamental contributions to science, and he's celebrated for these throughout the world. But I think his attraction to the empire came from his vision of what the world could be. The growth of the British Empire is the most important phenomenon of the 18th century. This little island on the northwest corner of Europe, with a quarter or a third of the population of France, emerges as the greatest and richest empire since the fall of Rome. So he wants to be part of that. He's got as much of a vision of this empire as, say, William Pitt. In England. So I think it's that. It's not the pomp and circumstance of the king, although he celebrates the coronation of George III as fully as anyone does. Huh. In fact, more so than most Brits. And his friends in London are surprised at how enthusiastic he is for the crown. They're criticizing their own country. They think it's becoming too luxurious, too corrupt. But he says quite the contrary. He says it's America that's corrupt. And he just looks back at America as being narrow and parochial. And he's in London where his enthusiasm for London matches Dr. Johnson's. Hmm. He just thinks anybody who lives in London at any length of time is going to never want to be happy anywhere else.
Is he a snob? Was he a snob?
Well, no, not a snob. But towards America, he does have letters that are really uncharacteristic of other Americans who are in London at the same time. John Dickinson, for example, of Philadelphia, who's here as a who's in London as a student. And all he does is write back to his parents, what a corrupt place, it's full of luxury, and he compares it to the simple qualities of Philadelphia. Not Franklin. He thinks the North American colonies are the backwater of the world. Mm. They're so parochial, so small-minded, and why can't they be like this cosmopolitan London?
Let's talk a little bit about the Stamp Act, because this seemed to be one of the events that certainly began Benjamin Franklin's turning away from the crown and from England, right, and turning towards the colonies. First of all, a short version of the Stamp Act.
Yes, in 1765, the British government is eager to find some sources of revenue to pay for the defense. The war was over with France, the big 7 years war, and they needed money, definitely. And they say, well, all these wealthy colonists, they should be paying something, since many of these troops are over there to protect them from the French and the Indians. They devise a tax on stamp tax on paper goods, newspapers and so on. Franklin, as an agent, lobbyist, if you will, for the Pennsylvania government, opposes the Stamp Act. He says, no, this is not a good thing. Most Americans opposed it. But Franklin takes a very pragmatic attitude. Well, all right, they're going to have it. Empires cost money. We need to have some kind of taxes. That's his view. Very pragmatic.
Right.
He engineers the appointment of his friend John Hughes in Philadelphia as stamp agent. That is the person who would distribute the stamps and cream off some profits in the process. Well, this action almost ruined Franklin's reputation in America. He recovers in 1766 by his four-hour testimony before the House of Commons. And Franklin's testimony, I think he rescues his reputation, because he comes down strong against taxation, internal taxation. He draws a distinction between internal and external. Of course, the Americans are just as much opposed to external taxes as they were to internal taxes. So Franklin's caught going the wrong way again. He doesn't know what his fellow Americans think about these things. He's so far away from them that he's lost contact.
This follows up then a scandal involving some letters that were written by this Massachusetts Governor Hutchison, which is sounds like this kind of seals
this is the end of
Franklin's affection
well,
for the
in the late
crown.
60s, he's ambivalent about the relationship in the empire, but he has dangled before him an office in the new department, American department. He would be second in command. It's stopped by Lord Hillsborough, who's a hardliner and doesn't like Franklin. It's at that point that Franklin writes his first part of his autobiography, in a moment of despair and anger. And it's a defiant section, that first section. He's saying, look, I'm an independent man. I don't have to be any lord's lackey, and so on. But in the meantime, he decides, well, I'm going to solve this imperial crisis. I'm going to send these Hutchinson letters, which were letters written by Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson in the 1760s, to a friend in London, in which Hutchinson unfortunately said such things as, we must curb some American liberties if we're going to solve this crisis. Well, Franklin gets a hold of these letters. We don't know how. And he sends them back to Massachusetts with the naive belief that if he can blame Hutchinson for the crisis, that the ministry, the cabinet back in England, will be absolved of responsibility for the crisis. And then the cabinet, Lord Dartmouth, who is now the head of the American department, who's a good friend of Franklin, he and Dartmouth can solve the whole thing in a half an hour. Well, he couldn't have been more wrong. It just blows up in his face. The British government, the Americans, of course, are furious at Hutchinson, and the British government is furious at Franklin, and they attack him in an hour-long diatribe in the cockpit, which is an amphitheater in Whitehall. He's with the whole court sitting around laughing and clapping while Franklin is viciously attacked by Solicitor General Wedderburn. So viciously that the British press felt that they could not publish everything that Wedderburn said.
So they humiliated
him. Oh, personal humiliation, which at that point, his career in England is virtually over. He goes back to America and becomes a flaming patriot.
Well, you write, the revolution was a very personal matter for Franklin, more personal perhaps than it was for any other revolutionary leader.
Yes.
Is this because he was so, as you say, publicly humiliated by...
Right. None of the other founders had that kind of personal humiliation. And he comes to the revolution with a real anger. He's ready for independence in May of 1775. Hmm. Nobody's really, they're all kind of cagey about it yet. There's still a year before the Declaration of Independence. We're at war, but no one's talking too openly about independence, but Franklin is. He wants independence now. He's,
well, here he is, a man of who very publicly expresses loyalty to the crown. He comes home to Philadelphia. What kind of reception does he get?
Well, actually, he gets in 1775. There's some suspicion that he might be a spy, so he has to ward that off. So some of his anger is calculated, but much of it is felt real. He's really angry, and he, as soon as the first opportunity comes to get back to Europe, when they looking around for somebody to send to Paris to see if we can't get the French in on our side, he volunteers for the job because he feels that he's a stranger in his own country. He doesn't know a lot of these people. They're not the people he knew earlier. He's been away for, 20 years.
But do you think then that there's something about, I don't want to call him a Zelig exactly, but that there's something about Franklin that he becomes a sort of a political Rorschach for this country, that we attach ourselves to certain aspects of his personality, of his character, of his life?
I think we're doing that with all the founders, but certainly Franklin has been manipulated perhaps the most in that respect. I don't think that the symbolic Franklin of capitalism is as strong as it once was, largely because capitalism is not as much the enemy as it used to be since the decline of Marxism.
Right. But do you think now that we know through your book more about his affection for the crown, his royal leanings, that we'll think less of him?
No, I don't think so. I think he's just a more interesting figure. He's just a more interesting person. He wasn't a patriot from the beginning, but a lot of Americans weren't. They didn't foresee the revolution. Most Americans in the 1750s were pretty loyal Brits. They weren't as loyal as Franklin, but they weren't ready yet for revolution.
That was my 2004 interview with historian Gordon Wood about his book, The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. This Sunday marks the 226th anniversary of Franklin's death. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about the nature of dreaming with writer Andrea Rock. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us today. What are dreams? We all experience these inexplicable adventures into the subconscious, but their purpose and the subject matter can be baffling. Philosophers, artists, as well as psychologists and researchers have long hypothesized about the nature of dreaming. Like many of us, writer Andrea Rock had been fascinated by her dreams and decided to dig into the research about why we dream. She explored the topic in her book, The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. She joined us back in 2005 to tell us some of the most compelling findings about our sleeping minds. Let's listen. I don't know if you've gone through periods where you've been a more active dreamer. And I remember when I was pregnant, going to sleep at night was like going to the movies practically. I mean, every night, I don't remember anything that I dreamed today, but I do remember just how vivid everything was.
Yes. You know, there are phases in which you have more active dream life than not. But generally, one of the things that's come out through dream research is, and particularly through the brain scanning imagery that allowed us to see what was actually happening, and that's only really been since the late 1990s, and it was a surprise to find that the emotional centers of the brain, the portions of the brain that are responsible for both generating emotion and for storing emotional memory, when you enter rapid eye movement sleep, which is when most, though not all, dreams occur, that portion of the brain becomes much more highly activated than it is even during waking. And so that's really what's, you know, calling the shots. And if you're in a period of your life where there's something going on that really has you emotionally charged, you're probably going to have a lot more active dream life.
Well, it's interesting to think about how important dreams have been to human beings over time. And certainly, you know, philosophers talked about it, psychologists, Freud, Jung, others talked about dreams as well. But today we're in this whole revolution in the field of brain technology. And I wonder how much you think that has really changed what it is that we understand about dreams. You were just talking about REM sleep and how we're able to look at what happens
to our brains while we are sleeping. Has that revolutionized the whole world of dreams?
Yes. It really wasn't until the mid-1950s that scientists really understood. Yes, there, I mean, there's always been this age-long right. fascination with dreams and dream content and the idea that maybe dreams predict the future and so on. But it really wasn't until the 50s, just sort of serendipitous discovery by a scientist who was actually started by recording the brain waves of his 8-year-old son mm-hmm. as he slept, that we discovered that the brain regularly enters these periods about every 90 minutes during sleep where it looks just like an awake brain in terms of brain activity. They also found during that period that coincided with the greatest proportion of dream reports from people when they would wake subjects. And so that launched this whole era of discovery. I mean, all kinds of crazy experiments. I mean, they were trying to see if they could influence dream content by showing people violent movies before they went to sleep, feeding them pizza or other strange things to see if that got incorporated. And most of it didn't have much effect. So really, the brain was a very independent director of the dream plot. The next discovery that was made that sort of gave further understanding was that the whole operating conditions of the brain during REM sleep are much different, that what's happening is the predominant brain chemicals that focus our attention, serotonin and sure. norepinephrine, drop dramatically, and the one that's most predominant is one that fosters this kind of out-of-the-box thinking, free association, entirely different kind of situation. And then when we were able to look through brain scanning and see what areas of the brain specifically were active and not so active, the whole part of the brain that directs our logical linear thought process during the day is pretty much turned down to idling speed, and it's really those emotional circuits that are fully charged.
But what's so interesting is this science really, I think, underscores the experience of dreaming. I mean, if you have any kind of awareness of it, that sounds perfect. That sounds
yes.
exactly like what we're doing when we're
exactly.
sleeping
and
dreaming.
That's why you have these, you know, your mother changes into Doris Day or, you know, you're
on a good day, right?
You're suddenly, you know, in a spaceship and then back in your kindergarten room. So all of that makes sense, and it also explains why some people say that they have creative breakthroughs in dreaming and they, you know, end up coming up with, you know, new music, new art, ideas for art, that sort of thing.
Well, you include some of these claims in the book. For instance, Paul McCartney claiming that the song Yesterday was something that he dreamed.
Yeah, that he was actually in London sleeping at his mom's house and awoke in the morning hearing a this tune in his head that was being played by a string quartet. It was so fully formed that he thought he'd heard it from some, you know, with someone else's music, and he was going around asking people, have you heard this? And they said, well, no, but it sounds like something you might have written. So finally he accepted it and wrote the words to Yesterday. So,
and you also talk about Jack Nicklaus and his golf grip.
Yes.
He was having a difficult patch in his career.
Right. And then coming up with a new way in his dream to do the swing. And mm-hmm. when he did it in waking life, it worked. And that actually is very common. One of the other things that we've learned is that dreaming phase of sleep in conjunction with other sleep phases plays an important role in learning and incorporating memory. And mm-hmm. so there are often, you know, musicians and athletes will report that they've had an improvement in performance after a couple of nights sleep, even if they haven't been practicing right. in the meantime. And that does make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm thinking of all those efforts. This may go against the research when we were all in school and you thought, well, if you played a tape of the, you know, all the capitals of the states while you were sleeping, that you could actually remember that or not.
Right. Well, that kind of learning actually seems to be reinforced during deep wave mm-hmm. sleep, which is, you know, not too accessible to right, any right. outside stimulus. So.
But you also say, and I think this is interesting, looking at, I guess, at REM sleep and looking also at this sort of short-term, long-term memory that people have, that the beginning of that REM sleep tends to deal with the more immediate present.
Right.
And that the longer that REM period goes, the deeper you get into your past. Your
yeah. As the night goes on, REM periods become longer. In the early part of the night, they're about 10 minutes. And then as the night goes on, they become longer and they incorporate things from memory that go further back into right. childhood. And that part of what science is showing us does support to some extent Freud's theory about dreaming, which was that it does involve processing of memory that may even be, you know, early mm-hmm. memories that aren't normally in our waking consciousness. Freud's basic theory was that dreams are expressing hidden wishes and desires.
Impulses.
Exactly. But that it also is all disguised and has to be decoded, their symbols and so on. The part that's supported is that, yes, we are accessing memory, and dreams are formed from all of these images that are called up from memory, and that they are linked to emotions, that basically you go to sleep with some emotional issue unresolved, and that as the night progresses, the brain is actually acting like a web browser on your computer, right, going through memory and trying to associate whatever that experience is with images and other experiences from memory that are somehow linked to that emotion that you're feeling. One line of research, Rosalind Cartwright, a researcher in Chicago, has been doing a lot of research on the therapeutic value of dreaming. And her contention is that as the night goes on, if the process works as it should, if the brain is able to make matches in memory with similar emotion that has resulted in something positive, by morning your mood actually is improved, that you've been able to process whatever the difficult emotion was, and you wake up in a better mood.
Well, it's interesting. You also write that there's a remarkable consistency in what an individual dreams over time. Maybe it's sort of if the experiences one has in life have this sort of browser connection, as you describe it, that, again, that makes a kind of sense.
Exactly. Yes. And there have been studies done of dream content that are interesting, both in an individual over time, people who keep dream journals over decades, and they find that consistency, mm-hmm, but also looking at different cultures and what, you know, not trying to interpret meaning, but what is it exactly, mm-hmm, that we dream about most, mm-hmm, often. And the most common dream theme is that of being chased by something or someone threatening. And that may have to do with a theory about the biological origins of dreaming, how REM sleep developed in the first place.
About survival.
Right.
That evolution.
It appears to have evolved in mammals about 140 million years ago. And the theory is as a means of processing survival-related information offline so that, you know, you're able to, you know, think about a new way to escape the tiger when you're not having to worry about actually being pursued by, right, the tiger.
I was wondering if our ancestors on the Serengeti Plain also dreamed about having a test for a class that they never took, which seems to be a dream that we have not only in high school and college, but with their variations of that, even in the working world. I've had some myself where I'm supposed to interview someone, I never read their book, blah, 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 you know, the same kind of anxiety, right?
Exactly. And that is the most predominant emotion that you see in dreams, you know, across cultures and through the ages. So, you know, and it may be in part because, you know, it's the whole function of that portion of sleep is rehearsing survival-related behavior. It's that the whole network in the brain that's the fight or flight instinct. So we're kind of running those programs and dealing with our difficult emotions that we as humans happen to have the burden and the gift of being aware of.
Exactly. So. You also talk about, in fact, fascinating description of a researcher, a fellow named Hobson, who actually had a stroke and, mm-hmm, went through a period of not sleeping, of not being able to sleep. And the craziness that he described that he felt was really quite vivid and quite upsetting. But then he finally did dream. And talk about this problem that he had and why that's important to understand.
Yes, he had it's interesting because he was a very important dream researcher who discovered that what appears to be the signal that triggers REM sleep comes from the brainstem, you know, which is sort of the most primitive part of the brain. And he, in fact, ended up having a stroke that affected only the brainstem.
Wow.
But the damage that was done, at least temporarily, but it was for a significant period, made it impossible for him to sleep. And, of course, he wasn't dreaming either. And what began to happen was he was having hallucinations that were, in a lot of cases, terrifying. And eventually, when the damage in the brainstem was repaired, he regained his ability to sleep normally and dream.
He talks about this is one of the horrible sort of hallucinations he had, the illusion that I was actually moving at a very high speed for at least 100 meters through space was so completely convincing and so terrifying that I said to myself, so this is what death is like.
Yes. And I think that's part of one of the things that was really fascinating to me in the research in general is, if you buy the idea that REM sleep and dreaming evolved as a means of rehearsing information that's important for survival, then the question is, well, how can just dreaming about something actually make you better at it? I mean, it's not real experience.
Right.
But, in fact, you begin to realize that the line isn't so clearly drawn between what's real and not real because what's happening in the brain is during REM sleep, except for your eye muscles, the rest of your body is essentially paralyzed so that you can't carry out the dream action. But those commands that your brain is issuing for you to act, to run up the tree, to escape the tiger and so on, are transmitted and the brain, the motor center of the brain, doesn't realize that they haven't been carried out. So from the brain's point of view, dreamed action is real. And that also explains why people report that they have an improvement in performance after sleep. But I think that's one of the interesting things that's come about is really understanding that, how our perception of experience really is a function of our brain, what's happening in our brain.
As far as our brain is concerned, we're out on the Serengeti. How about dreaming and children? How much research has been done just to look at the content of their dreams?
There was a researcher in those early days, David Foulkes, who did the most extensive study of children's dreams, ever. And he found that it seems to evolve, that dreaming itself seems to evolve in stages, our ability to dream in the way that we think of dreaming is over time, and that it's really not until children are around age 7 that they begin to have, more complex plots and with themselves figuring in the dream as an active character. And then it's not until age 11 that dreams begin to take on that, kind of emotional weight and dealing with a lot of emotional issues that we see in adults. And it's around that time that people frequently begin to have the dream of appearing, in public, not fully dressed and so on.
The kind of shame and embarrassment of
that.
Just to recap here, in terms of what scientists have been able to figure out, that dreaming in many ways is connected to memory and to learning, that there is that connection there.
Yes, that we are a large part of what's going on is that we're taking significant experience from daily life, and it's being transferred from kind of the buffer of short-term memory to long-term memory and integrated with past experience, and in humans, especially emotionally charged memory.
Right. And you write, both good psychotherapy and dreaming offer the same therapeutic benefit, allowing connections to be made in a safe place.
Yes, yes. And studies of people who have gone through trauma show that does tend to happen, that there's a pattern of replaying the event exactly as it happened, and then eventually just on its own, even without daytime therapy, that the plot of the dream changes. You mentioned the air traffic controller. There was another one of a woman who had been coming out of the World Trade Center and saw a lot of people coming out, falling out of the building, and replayed that experience in her mind in nightmares night after night. And then eventually the dream changed and she was able to give each one of them this kind of colorful parasol that allowed them to get to the ground safely. And after that, she stopped having the nightmares. Mm. So, it seems to be a process of nightly internal therapy to some extent.
That was my 2005 interview with writer Andrea Rock about her book, The Mind at Night, The New Science of How and Why We Dream. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Artie Moscowen. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.